Thank you, Brother Chairman. My dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ. Well, we're only going to cover four Bible passages this afternoon because, in fact, there isn't a great deal on Turkey. And yet, surprisingly, there's quite a lot, fortunately, in those four particular passages. And the first of those is in Revelation chapter 9, as we've had it read together this afternoon. So in Revelation chapter 9, then, the story begins in the 13th verse when it says that the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar which is before God, saying to the sixth angel which had the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. And the four angels were loosed which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year for to slay the third part of men. Now, we believe that the subject of the loosing of this particular, the sounding of this particular trumpet, the work of the sixth angel to loose the four angels of the great river Euphrates of the 14th verse, is in fact the story of the beginning of the uprising of the Turkish peoples. The first part of Revelation chapter 9 is given over to the story of the Saracen nation and the work that the Saracens accomplished, but from the 13th verse onwards to the work of the Turks. You'll notice in the 14th verse when it says, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. Well, they weren't actually in the river. In fact, the word in is the Greek preposition epi, and it's rendered by the Revised Standard Version. The Revised Version renders it as at, bound at the great river Euphrates. The Diaglot translates it as bound by the great river Euphrates, and that really would be a better translation of the idea. These four angels, whatever they were bound not inside the river, but by the river. The river constituted a border or a boundary which kept these four angels in check until the day came for the loosing of that boundary. And Brother Thomas says in the book of Eureka, he describes them as the four Euphratean angels because they had relationship, or their work bore relationship, to the crossing over of the river Euphrates. So here we have the river Euphrates here, going into the Persian Gulf and tracking its way back up into the very highlands of the Turkish region of Asia Minor here. And this river, the river Euphrates, constituted a boundary or a border over which the Euphratean angels could not pass until the angel loosed that boundary so that they could move forward. Now, the Turkish people, in fact, all sprang from this region of Central Asia across here. And they came in, well, in fact, four major waves. The first of those was the wave of the Seljuks, which came through in the 11th century. They used to live on this side of the Aral Sea, but they first of all moved southwards to camp alongside the shores of the Caspian Sea, and then they turned this way and moved across into the face of Asia Minor, down into Palestine, and more importantly, came across the river Euphrates. And they didn't come across that river until the time that God had ordained that they should make those forward movements. Togrul Beg, by the way, was the grandson of Seljuk, from whence this particular group of Turks derived their name. Eventually, although they conquered this whole region, they shrank into Anatolia, that is part of Turkey here. The Seljuks eventually came down into Anatolia, and they were later, in fact, overthrown by the Mongols. And the Mongols were really the second wave of Turks that came from the region of Asia. Now, in fact, the map that we've got there is not long enough, not wide enough, to do justice to where, in fact, the Mongols came from. We've got them as coming from up here, but in fact they came 5,000 miles northeast of Lake Balkhash. So that's a long way in that direction there, right up into the central steppes of Central Asia, an awful long way away, 5,000 miles away in that direction. And they came right through the area of Central Asia and down across into this area here, and they were led by a man called, as we've got him there, Genghis Khan. In fact, that wasn't his real name. His actual name was Tedjemin. Genghis Khan was his title. And Genghis Khan as a title means Lord of the Earth, or Universal Sovereign. And he took that title to indicate the extent of the dominion that he intended to conquer. He was one of the four Euphratean angels that were loosed at this particular stage of world history, according to Revelation chapter 9. Now, the Mongols were perhaps the most fierce of all the Turkish tribes, and they came sweeping down through this area. They, in fact, made advances into Russia. They went into China, across into China. They went into Mesopotamia. They went into India. The Mongols went absolutely everywhere under the leadership of this fierce man, Genghis Khan. But eventually, they were superseded by another group of Turks who arose from this area here, who were known as the Tatars, who were led by a man called Tamerlane. In fact, Tamerlane himself was born in a valley just south of Samarkand. And Samarkand became the capital area, the base, if you like, for Tamerlane's operations. Actually, he was known both as Tamerlane, and also he was known as Timur Lenk, which means Timur the Lame One, because he was lame in one leg and he had a crippled arm. And yet this man was one of the most fierce warriors that the world ever saw, and he led the Tatars in incredible battles. In fact, when he died, he was actually embarked upon a campaign, I think in this region here. He was actually on his horse at the time. He was over 70 years of age, and he was leading his army on horseback into battle at over 70, lame in one leg, crippled in his arm, and he fell off stone dead. Amazing, absolutely amazing man, and a very, very fierce one at that. And the final of the four Euphratean angels was, in fact, the Ottomans themselves, who sprang from this region here, and who, in fact, were first led by a man called Othman, from whence the tribe derived its name. So we believe that the four Euphratean angels relate to the four successive waves of Turkish people, and in each case led by a notable leader, Togrul Beg, Genghis Khan, Tamerlane, and Othman, who came across the river Euphrates at the time that that border was unloosed for them. And you notice what they were there to do, verse 15. They were released for a specific purpose according to the principles of God. It says that the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year, for to slay the third part of men. Now the phrase "the third part of men" relates, we believe, to the third part of the Roman Empire, which was in fact the Eastern Roman Empire. Well, in fact, we can't quite see it. If we just imagine Turkey finishing here, and the Black Sea coming back down here, this is the area of Constantinople, and that's where the Eastern Roman or Byzantine Roman Empire was. The Roman Empire of the day had broken into three sections, and the responsibility of these four Euphratean Turkish angels was to slay the third part of men. That is, to destroy the Eastern Roman Empire. Now you'll notice that that's in contrast to verse 5. Because of the Saracens, it was recorded that to them it was given that they should not kill them, but that they should be tormented 5 months. So the work of the Saracens was to torment the Eastern Roman Empire, but it fell to the work of the Turks to actually destroy the Eastern Roman Empire and to slay the third part of men. And so they did, of course, because in the very waves of Turkish people that came across this area, eventually the Byzantine Empire fell, and we'll have a look at that shortly. You'll notice that in verse 16 it says, "And the number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000,000, or 2 myriads of myriads, and I heard the number of them, and thus I saw the horses in the vision." So what the record of Revelation notes here is that these Euphratean powers were noted in particular for their use of the horse. And that is exactly the peculiar feature of army and military life amongst the Turks. Their horse was their chief military asset. That was the principal military strategy of all four of these Turkish groups. Alp Arslan, who was one of the successors of Togrul Beg of the Seljuks, he fought against Constantinople with 40,000 horses. Malik Shah, who was one of his successors, had a hunting train, this was just his hunting stable, of 47,000 horses. That was just his hunting stable. Ishmael, who was a Seljuk, when Muhammad was in trouble, offered him the assistance of 200,000 horses. In 1098, when the Crusaders had an army of 100,000 horses, they were met by Suleiman, one of the Turkish generals, who had 300,000 horses. Tamerlane invaded Persia with 90,000 horses. Genghis Khan had 500,000 horses. In fact, it's been computed that if you added up the number of horses that really did exist throughout the four Euphratean angels, that they would in fact come to 200,000. The very number, in fact, specified in the book of Revelation. And we know, of course, that the balance of these verses go on to speak about this strange thing about the brimstone and the power in their mouths and the sting in their tails, which we do believe to be a reference to gunpowder, which was a special technique that, in particular, the Turks had devised, and by which they were successful in developing their empire and overthrowing the Byzantine Empire as a result. I was going to try and put an overhead up here of the growth of the empire, but I don't know that I'm going to be able to do it because they're all in slightly different places. So I'll just there'll be a moment for a technical hitch here. Well, look, that's not perfect, but we can probably get the idea here of the growth of the empire. What happened was the power of the Turks started in this little region here actually that's still not right, is it? Let me just keep the light off and we'll just make a move there. That should go across to there. Right, that's slightly better. And that should go to there. Right. And that still can't be quite right because I can see from that I've got something wrong in there. But the main idea to show here is the tremendous way in which the Turkish power grew. So it started off with a little region here in the middle of Asia Minor, and then in fact it grew by means of the purple region across into Europe and the rest of Asia, the rest of Turkey rather, and then added extra land here on the other side of the Black Sea, and then added this area of Palestine, and then added the parts of Africa across into Persia, further into Europe, and finally across to the Caspian Sea. Now, by the time the Ottoman Empire grew to its largest extent there, what it had effectively done was it had acquired all the territory that once belonged to the Eastern Roman Empire, the third part of men. It had taken it over. So the Eastern Roman Empire had been effectively destroyed by the loosing of the four Euphratean angels. Happened to be the Ottomans, by the way, who finally came to power. What happened was the Seljuks and the Mongols and the Tartars eventually exhausted themselves, and the Ottomans successfully amalgamated all that was left of the Turkish power, and they were the ones who then began to build the what became known, of course, as the Ottoman Empire, taken from the name of their particular tribe. When did the Byzantine Empire fall, by the way? Constantinople, the head of the Byzantine Empire, when did it fall? Anybody know? Sorry? Yes, quite correct. 1453 was the in the middle of that very expansion of the Turkish Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire fell to the Turks in 1453, and by that means Revelation chapter 9 and verse 15 had been fulfilled, that the four Euphratean angels loosed in order that they might now cross over the river Euphrates had indeed slain the third part of men. The Byzantine Empire had fallen, and the myriads of the Turkish horses had moved across the face of Asia Minor and built their own empire in the very process of fulfilling God's purpose. Now, the interesting thing about God and his dealings with the nations is that he does use them for the accomplishment of specific objectives. And when those objectives are fulfilled, then in fact he may do something else with that nation. And that in fact is exactly what happened to Turkey. They were allowed to grow. They were allowed to come across the River Euphrates. They all moved from Central Asia into the area of Asia Minor. And their purpose being accomplished to overthrow the Byzantine or the Eastern Roman Empire, they were allowed to then expand their power, but only to a certain point where it then became necessary in the purpose of God for their power in certain regions to be diminished. And that really takes us to our next Bible passage, which happens to be Revelation 16, which we've just come from in our last session. But coming back to the verse before the one we looked at, looking now at the 12th verse of Revelation 16, rather than the 13th verse. Now, you'll notice what this verse says. It says, "And the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared." Actually, funnily enough, if you look at modern Europe today, some people might say, well, that doesn't seem to be a very good symbol for the Euphrates doesn't seem to be a very good symbol for the Turkish power, because the Turkish power basically is here, isn't it? So what people could say is, well, how does the river Euphrates stand as a symbol of the Turkish power? And the answer is, well, of course, at the time the vial was poured out, the Turks controlled all of this area, including the entire length and breadth of the river Euphrates. It very much was at the heart of their empire at the time the vial was poured out. It's not today. But it's no good looking at Turkey today and saying, well, it doesn't seem to be represented by the river Euphrates. The river Euphrates was the appropriate symbol for the Turkish power at the time of the pouring out of the vial. Now, notice what it doesn't say. It doesn't say, "and the waters thereof were dried up." It says, "and the water, singular, thereof was dried up." That's not the same thing. Waters, in the plural, stand in the scripture and in the book of Revelation particularly as representative of peoples. But this is not in the plural, this is in the singular. There's only one other place in the book of Revelation where the term water is used in the singular. And again, we won't turn to it now, but you might like to take a note of it. It's Revelation chapter 12 and verse 15, which says that the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman. And we believe that the water that was cast out of the mouth of the dragon on that occasion had reference to the military power of the dragon. So when it says in Revelation 16 and verse 12, "the water thereof is dried up," we believe that more specifically it has reference to the drying up of the military power of Turkey, not just the decline of it territorially. The water of the river stands for the military power of the nation. And the drying up here of the river Euphrates, the water thereof, stands for the fact that the military prowess and supremacy of the Ottoman Empire, as so great and mighty at one particular stage, was in fact to be diminished in order that the next stage of God's purpose could be advanced. In fact, it says so that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. Well, is that what happened? And the answer is yes. When we look at the history of the nation, we find that indeed, in many, many different and remarkable ways, the water of the river Euphrates was dried up. Now, we're just going to have a look at one or two key areas. Now, you see what I've stressed here? It's not just a loss of territory. It relates to the whole diminishing of the power of the Ottoman Empire in several different ways. Let's take, first of all, natural disasters. Just approximately, when were these vials poured out, the vials of Revelation 16? When did Napoleon enter upon the face of Europe and pour out the vials upon the beast system? Sorry? Yes, in the 19th century, in the 1800s, wasn't it? Let's say the first the first half of the 19th century. So here we have, at the same time, a vial being poured now upon the River Euphrates. Let's take the subject, first of all, of unnatural disasters. In the year 1821, there were 100,000 cholera deaths in the Turkish Empire, and thousands more perished in a strange series of earthquakes that occurred in that year. In the year 1826, this is quite an interesting one actually, in the year 1826, does anyone know what the Janissaries were, or who the Janissaries were? Who or what were the Janissaries? Anyone know? The Janissaries were the special army of the Turkish emperor, and they were in fact non-Turks. They were always recruited from other nations, and they were dedicated from childhood to be his fighting army. They were the cream of the Turkish army. They were in fact the central core of the Turkish army. They were the key to his fighting force. Well, on this particular occasion in 1826, what happened was the Turkish leader of the day decided that he would like to start another army, and the Janissaries didn't agree, naturally enough. They were a very powerful group. So he invited them all into Constantinople, got them all into a square, and promptly shot the lot of them. And in one dreadful massacre, 30,000 Janissaries, the very core of his army, were slain just like that. That's part of the drying up of the River Euphrates, the drying up of the military power of this once mighty empire. And in fact, really, from that point on, the military power of the Turks was very much in question. By the year 1831, it could be said that Constantinople, the capital, had lost 50% of its population over the previous 20 years through unnatural deaths. 300,000 to 400,000 people had died of unnatural deaths in 20 years. Constantinople was literally cut in half in terms of population. These were strange things that were happening in the midst of this nation. They weren't strange to us. We knew what they were. Well, we would have been if we'd been there. They were part of the drying up of that particular power. God is able to work in all sorts of ways. In 1845, there was an outbreak of plagues that swept through the whole empire. In 1864, there were thousands of fires that occurred in that particular year, and an enormous number of buildings that were destroyed. These were all apparently unrelated, unnatural disasters. And yet through them all, the power of the Turkish Empire was greatly diminished. And one can see the hand of God in these apparently unrelated things that were all moving towards the outworking of God's purpose. What about the subject of wars? In 1827, the Turkish fleet was destroyed in the Battle of Navarino. In 1832, Muhammad Ali defeated the Turks at Konya. Konya. Actually, that's interesting. Konya. You want to know what that was in Bible times? Actually, a Bible place. There was an ecclesia at Konya. I'll give you a clue. It was on the first missionary journey to Galatia, wherein the apostle established the truth throughout the area of Galatia, which of course is in the middle of Turkey. Would you like to have a stab on that? What was it known in Bible times? Well, it wasn't Lystra, and it wasn't Derbe, but it was Iconium. Iconium became Konya. So that's actually the Iconium of biblical days. And Muhammad Ali defeated the Turks at Iconium, which was really smack in the middle of their own area. In 1853, Russia made gains in the Crimean War. In 1877, there was the Russo-Turkish War. In 1897, the Greco-Turkish War. In 1912, the Balkan War. And what happens was that the Turkish Empire found itself faced with enemies on every side that were all chipping away at its power. God had set in motion the drying up of a river. And once the order had gone forth by Almighty God that That, in fact, is exactly what took place. There was no body, no thing that could stop that particular decline. Let's have a look at the actual loss of territories as the river dried up. In 1827, Greece became independent. In 1830, Algeria was annexed by France. In 1878, Serbia, Romania, Montenegro became independent. In 1878, Cyprus was taken by Britain. In 1881, Tunisia was lost to France. In 1882, Egypt was occupied by Britain. 1908, Bulgaria independent. 1911, Italy takes Tripoli. 1912, Italy takes Libya. 1912 again, Crete ceded to Greece. 1914, Palestine free. 1915, Syria taken by France. The river was really drying up. It's an amazing story. There was just nothing that could stop that. You know, in those days, and these were the days of Brother Thomas, of course, and Brother Roberts, these things were known as the Eastern Question. And do you know what Turkey was known as in those days? You know what you know? The sick old man of Europe. And in fact, the Allies tried to prop up the Turkish Empire to keep it going, because they were concerned about the development of other powers. And one of them, by the way, was the advent of Russia. And they wanted to keep the Turkish power intact as a buffer against Russian intentions. And it didn't matter what the Allies did. Disaster upon disaster continued to strike the Turkish Empire, because God had marked out that that power would be dried up. Revelation 16 verse 12. It's an amazing thing. And although it doesn't show clearly in that particular list of territories being lost, there was one particular power above all others that became the greatest enemy of Turkey. The greatest single enemy of Turkey, resulting in loss of territories and ultimately in the development of great fear in the Turkish people, was in fact the power of Russia, who contributed greatly to the drying up of this Turkish power. And that takes us to our next Bible passage, which of course is in the book of Daniel and chapter 11. Now, in the book of Daniel, chapter 11, we read in the 40th verse, "At the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and horsemen and with many ships." When I was a lad, I always imagined that there were two kings fighting against here, the king of the north and the king of the south. It wasn't until someone gave a lecture at some stage and said, no, there's actually three powers in Daniel 11 and verse 40 that one had to investigate a little closer. In fact, it's quite a good little exercise to take a coloured pencil and just to have a look at this connection. Because you see, in verse 40, when it says, "At the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him." Thank you, brother. The hymn of Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40 is not actually either the king of the south or the king of the north. Now, here's a very simple way to show that. You get your coloured pencil. Well, let's take an ordinary pencil if that's all you've got, because you can always rub it out later on. So you colour in the word hymn in verse 40. Now, if we go back to verse 39, who is the hymn that was the hymn of verse 40? Who's that in verse 39? The answer is, it's the he. Thus shall he do. So the hymn of verse 40, when we go back to verse 39, is the he of verse 39. Now, coming back to verse 38, that becomes the his. But in his estate shall he honour the God of forces. So the his of verse 38 is the he of verse 39. Coming back to verse 37, that's the he. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers. And coming back to verse 36, who's the he of verse 37? When we come back to verse 36, the answer is, and the king. So there's actually three kings in Daniel 11 verse 40. And tracing it through from verse 36, it's really quite simple. So we have the king, verse 36. And he shall regard, verse 37, in his estate shall he honour, verse 38, thus shall he do, verse 39, and at the time of the end shall the king of the south push against him, verse 40. And so the him of verse 40 is actually the king of verse 36.
good Bible study is based on good Bible reading. So there's three kings in Daniel 11 verse 40. Three kings: the king of the north, the king of the south, and the king of verse 36. Now, if we were to say, well, who's the king of verse 36? The answer is, as we've said in our earlier study, as Brother Thomas calls him, the Constantinopolitan autocracy, the power enthroned in Constantinople down through time, whoever that might be. Different powers have controlled Constantinople down through time. But as far as we're concerned, from the time of the establishment of the Ottoman Empire, the king of verse 36 has been the Turkish power. That is the power in control of Constantinople, and has been from the time of the dissolution of the Eastern Roman Empire in 1453. From that time, the Turks have always controlled Constantinople, and they do today. So what Daniel 11 verse 40 is saying is, at the time of the end shall the king of the south push against Turkey, and the king of the north shall come against Turkey like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. Now notice there's two different things here. The king of the south, all he does is merely push against Turkey. And there's been various explanations as to perhaps what that push was. One of the suggestions is at the time that General Allenby liberated Palestine from the power of the Turks, and in so doing gave the Turks a push. Maybe that was the case. What we do believe is that the king of the south may have already pushed at Turkey, but the king of the north has not yet come against Turkey, because when it does, he'll completely overthrow the king of verse 36, because verse 40 says he'll come like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, many ships, and shall overflow. And the word overflow means that he'll conquer the king of Turkey. Now we believe, of course, that the king of the north is undoubtedly Russia. And so what Ezekiel 11 and verse 40 is saying is that the time is yet to come when the power of Russia will make a move southwards, and in the course of doing that will in fact conquer Turkey. And it's just interesting over the last two or three centuries to just see what's happened, whereby the power of Russia has gradually built to become the greatest enemy that Turkey fears. In the 17th century, there was a number of wars in this particular area of the Crimea, which of course is over the top of the the Black Sea, isn't it? And the net result of those battles in the 17th century was that Russia took control of that land area to the north of the Black Sea. Now, Turkey, of course, is just to the south. This is Turkey here, isn't it? So Turkey became very, really quite nervous as Russia advanced ever increasingly south, looking towards Turkey. Now it had gained control over the area to the north of the Black Sea. Over the next 100 years, over the course of the 18th century, the Russians added a great deal of territory, not only around the Black Sea area, but around the Caspian as well. They took this area here of Georgia. So they took this area of Georgia here, down between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. They also took territory right around this side of the Caspian, and also some further territory on the shores of the Black Sea itself. And Turkey could feel that growing presence of Russia ever drawing closer to what was, and that's all that's left, of course, of the once great Turkish Empire, shrunk now into this little area here, and with Russia looking increasingly powerful against her. At the end of World War I, there was a secret treaty between the Allies, and what they decided to do is really, I suppose, awarding themselves the spoils of victory in the course of World War I, they decided to partition up this particular area, and everyone was going to get a bit of extra land as a present. Well, this is the bit that Russia got offered in the secret treaty with the Allies. Just pop it on carefully, and you can see just what it would have meant as far as Turkey was concerned. So here's the area that Russia was offered at the end of World War I. So again, encroaching ever further, and including Constantinople. So if they had won that territory, and that was how the area this is how this area had been partitioned up by the Allies, Russia would have gained control of this part of Turkey and the city of Constantinople. She would have become the dragon if that had happened. But it wasn't the time for her to become the dragon. And what happened was, a man called Mustafa Kemal, later known of course as Kemal Ataturk, in fact rallied the Turks together and fought the War of Independence, and the Republic of Turkey was declared in 1923, and the Russians were driven out, and so was everyone else driven out, and Turkey retained its integrity as a nation and included the control of Constantinople, and the desires and ambitions of the Russians were thwarted on that occasion. At the end of the Second World War, Russia claimed this little spot here. They claimed they wanted to be able to set up a military outpost at the Dardanelles and also to have a military centre at Alexandroupolis, so that they could in fact pass ships through this area of the Bosphorus and out into the Mediterranean. And they claimed that area there at the end of World War II. So you can see that for a long time, Russia has had covetous eyes cast on the territory of in fact Turkey. It's been looking at that particular area for a long time. And that's what Daniel 11 says, verse 40, that at the time of the end, the power that finally will overrun Turkey and totally conquer it is in fact the King of the North. And it's not too hard, just to look at that map, it's not too hard to work out who the King of the North is as far as Turkey is concerned. And just one or two interesting things with regard to that. Some of you may know that in fact at a certain place, I'm not sure where it is, but at a certain place running up to the Turkish border, the Russians have built a 6-lane highway, very nicely asphalted. And from time to time they have a little exercise where they run tanks down the road, and at the last minute they turn, just to let the Turks know that they're there, and that the day might come when the King of the North will decide to make its move. How's this for an extract from a Canadian newspaper in the light of Daniel 11? The Soviet invasion of Turkey exercise. A Soviet strategic exercise designed to test an invasion of Turkey was successfully carried out last month. This is 2 or 3 years ago. Codenamed Kafkaz 85, the exercise was staged in a 100-kilometre area on the north side of the Kura River, southeast of Tiflis, and within 200 kilometres of both the Turkish and Iranian border. The exercise, reading further down, spanned 25,000 ground troops, 6 days, and the victorious Soviet commander was reported to have made maximum use of both firepower and mobility. Now here's the real punchline to this particular map, this particular article. The Soviet Union is estimated to maintain a 7-to-1 force superiority compared to NATO forces in this region. So when you hear talks of disarmament and of peace treaties and so on, the superiority of the Russian forces in this area is 7-to-1 compared to NATO. We're not surprised at that, are we, in the light of Daniel chapter 11 and the obvious intentions at some stage of the King of the North coming down to push at him. So the King of the North is busy engaged in little sort of practice runs at the moment, just to see how it could work out. And that really means that the focus of our attention at the moment perhaps ought to be, as far as Turkey's concerned, on this vulnerable area here, this northern border that they share with the region of Russia. And that really takes us to our next Bible quotation, which is Ezekiel chapter... Now, what chapter in Ezekiel would it be, I wonder? Ezekiel chapter 38. Now, in Ezekiel chapter 38, we have reference to Turkey under a certain heading, and this is how it's described in Ezekiel chapter 38. In Ezekiel 38, concerning the various nations that will be part of the Russian advance at the time of the end, it says in the 6th verse, Gomer and all his bands, the house of Tagama of the North Quarters and all his bands. Now the question is, where exactly is the house of Tagama? Well, here's some definitions as to what the house of Tagama is all about. First of all, Elpis Israel, page 429. And Brother Thomas says there, Russian and independent Tartary are the countries of Tagama from which in former times poured forth the Turkoman cavalry. Georgia and Circassia probably are bands of Tagama's house. So Brother Thomas pinpoints the house of Tagama as belonging to this area here between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. Delitzsch says in his commentary on Ezekiel, volume 1, page 393, he says, Tagama is one of the names of the Armenians, and he refers to Strabo. He says that Strabo, in fact, mentions the wealth of the Armenians in horses. That's the old military might of the Turks, isn't it? Whilst that in asses is attested by Herodotus. Smith's Bible Dictionary has a very interesting comment on the house of Tagama. It says, Tagama in Sanskrit is actually Tokak tribe and Arma, Armenia, the tribe of the Armenians, Tagama. They were the dominant race in the peninsula and they spread westwards from the confines of Armenia to the shores of the Aegean Sea. That's modern Turkey, isn't it? So the house of Tagama, we believe, takes up this whole area of modern Turkey, but also including Armenia, Georgia, Circassia, that region there, in fact, to the north of Turkey, which at the moment forms part of Russia. So that's really where the focus of our attention should be. So let's, in fact, have a look at that region and blow it up in a bit more detail and see what we can find out. So here we've put our magnifying glass on, and we're now going to have a look at that region in a slightly blown-up version. So here's the Black Sea again. Here's the Black Sea and the Caspian, but we've magnified the area in between. So here's the shore of the Black Sea, blown up, and here's the Caspian Sea. Here's Russia. Here's Turkey. Here's Iran. So this is actually a very, very critical... This is a critical place as far as the nations are concerned. Here is the border of Russia, Turkey, and Iran. It's a very volatile little area. Let's just first of all put the main roads and mountains on. That's quite interesting. So here's the main area. Here's the main roading parts of this particular area. We have, first of all, oh, by the way, Stavropol. Does anybody know somebody that comes from Stavropol? Quite notable in Russian politics, or certainly was. Well, in fact, Gorbachev, Mikhail Sergeyevich Gorbachev, is the man from Stavropol. He knows this area pretty well. He actually comes from this area. Here's the border between Russia, therefore, and Turkey. There are several major cities. There's Yerevan, Leninakan, Tbilisi, and Orchanakaytsky. Now, in between these two cities here, Orchanakaytsky and Tbilisi, this is the Greater Caucasus range of mountains, the purple here, and the Lower Caucasus range of mountains here. And you'll notice that this road is actually drawn a little stronger, because that is known as the Georgian Military Highway. It's an enormous road that goes straight over the top of the mountains. And it was built especially for the transport of military materials. There's Armenia, that's this region here, and this is Azerbaijan over here. So these are the three Russian provinces of the area. And of course, Edvard Shevardnadze is now, of course, in charge of Georgia, and they have a lot of unrest there at the moment. This is in fact the area of Armenia. Now, the interesting thing about this is I actually read a tourist guide on travel in this area, you know, if you were going to have a holiday. Not that I was actually intending to have one, but just wanted to know a little bit about the area. One of the things it said was that in the whole of the Russian, you know, in the whole of the United Soviet Socialist Republic of the day, this had one of the most excellent set of roads anywhere. Excellent roads, they said, everywhere. I wonder why they'd have such excellent roads just sort of close to the Turkish border. A few years ago in Armenia, there was an earthquake. You remember that large earthquake? It was actually centred in just off Leninak. In fact, here it is. I don't know if you can see can you see the little orange circles there? The earthquake was just there. And it badly damaged the city of Leninakan, which is just about on the border. Now, the roads there were excellent, but as a result of that, they've had to rebuild a lot of the main roads northwards, and I'm sure they'll do an excellent job when they build those particular roads, because this is obviously a crucial area as far as they're concerned. Now, just overlaying something over the top of that, what this represents here is the territory of ancient Armenia. So you can see that the territory of Armenia, if we superimpose that across the top, that Armenia is basically lying more at the moment in Turkey than it does in Armenia itself. Here's modern Armenia, right? And here is the balance of ancient Armenia. It basically lies, well, in fact, I think the areas are as 11,500 square miles of ancient Armenia lies in modern Armenia in Russia, and 57,000 square miles of ancient Armenia lies in Turkey. So what you've really got is a situation whereby the Armenian people at the moment are divided, and they would quite like to sort of be unified again. And so you've got forces already that create tensions across this Russian-Turkish border that we can see would easily one day lead to some form of invasion in order that the area of Armenia might be conquered and brought under Armenian control. So these roads, you can see that these roads come right down to the border and then through into Turkey. There are several major roads that come straight across from Russia, straight through into Turkey. Now, interestingly enough, the symbol of the Armenians on their flag, their national symbol, is Mount Ararat. Anyone know where Mount Ararat is on this map here? Is it in Turkey or is it in Russia? I'd like to have a... Yes, it's in Turkey. It's about... Now, I've got to get this right. I think it's about there. It's about there. Well inside the Turkish side of things. But the symbol of the Russian Armenians is Mount Ararat. That's on their flag. Well, the Turks weren't too happy about that. And so they said, look, you can't have that symbol because that belongs to us. You know, that doesn't, you know, you can't have Mount Ararat on your flag because it doesn't belong to you. And the Armenians said, oh, yes, we can, because they said, your flag, you've got a crescent on your flag. That's the moon. The moon doesn't belong to you. So if the moon doesn't belong to you, we can have Mount Ararat on our flag as well. So there's a lot of tension in this area because of ethnic conflicts, you know, that in fact lie straddling this Russian-Turkish frontier. And what we're suggesting is that the scene is certainly set for further unrest in this area, and we believe that perhaps through this very area, the King of the North will ultimately pass Daniel chapter 11 and making his pass that he comes against the king of Constantinople. So what we've really got, and this is how Turkey feels at the moment, Turkey's really in an ever tightening circle. It's got Russia facing it here, Iran facing it here, Iraq facing it here, Syria, Greece, Bulgaria, Romania, Russia. It's really feeling the sense of enclosure. It's marked out by God to fall into the hands of the Russians at some stage, because when Gog comes in Ezekiel 38, the house of Tagama has fallen in to the Russian side of things. Actually, there's some Turks, quite a number of Turks, living in Bulgaria, because there's a number of Turks over here on the Bosphorus, the area of Constantinople, and beyond that in Bulgaria there's a number of Turks living, several million Turks actually, and the Bulgarians got a bit tough and they decided to introduce some new rules in Bulgaria that if you didn't have a Bulgarian name and Bulgarian passport and so on, you couldn't own property, and in other words, discriminatory laws against the Turks. And so the Turkish government got pretty upset with this, and they wrote a very stiff note to the Bulgarian government. They said, look here, We've got, you know, just remember that whilst you might only have a few million Turks in Bulgaria, there's another 20 or 30 million Turks here, so you better watch out what you do. And the Russians, when they heard of that, they sent a stiff letter back to Turkey saying, yes, and we're just above Bulgaria too, and if you do anything against Bulgaria, we'll move, so you watch out what you do. And there was a bit of a political spat went on. It was a very tense area. The scene is set for the taking of Turkey in accordance with Bible prophecy. Actually, we used to have an old saying at school that said, Russia got hungry, so it ate a bit of Turkey, slipped on Greece and broke a bit of China. Well, it's one of those silly things that you learn as a child. And indeed, we think that one day Russia is certainly going to eat a bit of Turkey. Now, just to close then, one or two comments from the pioneer writings. And this, I think, just helps to put it in perspective. Here's the first thing. Brother Thomas says in Elpis Israel that he believes that Turkey will fall by armed invasion. He says the Russo-Assyrian autocrats shall attack Constantinople by sea and land, and with such whirlwind impetuosity that the Sultan's dominion shall be swept away. The whirlwind nature of the attack implies, I think, not only its overwhelming character, but that when it is made, the allies of the Sultan will be off their guard by the autocrats' assurances of peace and moderation, for which they will give him credit. You know, Brother Thomas's words always have a fresh appeal, don't they, in terms of modern circumstances, even though written a long time ago. He says to enter into the countries, Daniel 11 implies invasion, but to overflow and pass over implies conquest. So Brother Thomas says, reasoning from Daniel chapter 11, as well as other places, he says, I believe that Turkey will fall by armed conquest. The king of the north will in fact overrun Turkey from a military point of view. That's the first interesting thing. Moving to the exposition of Daniel, here's the second interesting point. Turkey will fall before Europe is united. So remember, we're looking for the final stage of the beast and the uniting of Europe. Well, says Brother Thomas in exposition of Daniel, Turkey has got to go into Russia's orbit of things before the final stage of European unification can take place. The Ottoman dynasty must, of course, be driven out of Europe. The occupation of the Dragon's Throne by a non-Catholic royalty is clearly exceptional. The power causing false prophetism to prosper must hold Constantinople at the crisis of the accomplishment of the indignation. Hence the Sultan must be ejected, that a dynasty patronising a high priest who forbids to marry may come in. When therefore the Tsar gets possession of Constantinople, he will not be hostile to the Pope. On the contrary, he will honour and acknowledge him. And Brother Thomas goes on to show that the taking of Turkey is a necessary prerequisite so that the final stages of European unification can then occur. So therefore, although we're looking to see that system of things develop in Europe, the warning of the writings of the pioneers is that in fact, if anything, we'll see Turkey fall before we see the final stages of European development. So keep an eye on Turkey. Keep an eye on that region of Armenia. There's the spot, we believe, where the king of the north will make his move and the house of Tagama will fall. And here's the last one. This really makes you stop and think. Brother Thomas says in Eureka that Turkey will fall after Christ has come. He says the sixth vial is in part to remove Gentile power to convenient distance, to diminish, not to increase it in the region, to substitute the Russian in Constantinople for the Turk, and to give the Tsar dominion over the Ottoman before Christ comes would render nugatory the drying up process. The greater Euphratean Ottoman power is not dried up to prepare the way of the greater power of Gog, but that the way of the kings out of the sun's rising might be prepared. Brother Thomas shows in that particular section of Eureka in the third volume that he believes that when Turkey does finally fall to Russian invasion, Christ will already be in the earth. So we probably won't see it. We probably won't see the final fall of Turkey into Russian hands, the final stages of European unification, because Christ will already be here. It'll be too late by that stage if we are to trim our lamps and to be ready for the coming of the Lord. So there, brothers and sisters, at least in brief, is a survey of the destiny of Turkey from a biblical point of view. They were the Euphratean angels loosed in order that the power of the Eastern Roman Empire might be destroyed.
They advanced mightily across the river Euphrates to accomplish that. When God had, by using them, accomplished his purpose, he caused that power to decline. By natural disaster, by war, by loss of territory, the Euphratean power of Turkey was marvellously dried up in such a remarkable way that not even other powers could stop that process from occurring. In the very process of that drying up power occurring, Russia steadily advanced to become enemy number one as far as Turkey was concerned, in accordance with what we would expect from Daniel chapter 11, and the final state of things to be that she does indeed fall into the power of the Russians, as Ezekiel 38 tells us. So certainly the very state of tension that we see in the Turkish area right now would lead us to believe that there's nothing that needs to happen before Christ comes. Christ indeed is at the door as far as these prophetic matters are concerned. I'm not aware of anything in the prophetic order of things that must be fulfilled, yet to be fulfilled, before Christ comes. There's still a number of things to happen. There's nothing that has to happen before Christ returns. So in order that he does not come as a thief upon us, let us indeed look up and lift up our heads, for the coming of the judge draws nigh.